I'd like to introduce our speaker, whom I'm sure a lot of you already know. It's Mr. Jim Watt, a past president of the Duart and House Society and still on our committee. He's going to speak to us about shipwrecks and maritime history of the East Coast. And Jim has had a very long-standing interest in all things maritime. In fact, as someone said, he's got salt in his veins. Right through his family history, he's had an involvement with shipping and that kind of thing, which he will explain to you more fully. So without further ado, I'd like to hand over the floor to you, Jim. Thank you very much.
Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming on a nice sunny morning. It's good to be inside in a way. When Rose initially asked me to give this talk, it was going to be on the East Coast shipwrecks. And I've mulled that over for some time. And then I thought, well, there are other things that actually I have researched more myself. The shipwrecks of Hawke's Bay are fairly well recorded and are all published. And it's been the tradition of these talks more to be on work that is current and research that people are doing at the moment. However, I realised that probably there are two talks here, and I have suggested that maybe sometime in the future I might give the second talk, which will be aspects of maritime history that sort of lead on from shipwrecks, or shipwrecks introduce us into the topic. But right at the moment, I just want to confine our discussion to the wrecks on the east coast of the North Island, and we'll look at 10 of them that are of particular interest and see where that takes us. I know these maps are not very clear to you, but that's East Cape, and this map actually sits underneath that one. So it's East Cape to Gisborne, and then from Gisborne down through Napier to Cape Turnagain, and Cape Turnagain down to Cape Palliser. So anyway, here's the east coast of the North Island. I need to say that I'm really just recapping what's already published, and if any of you don't know the book of Linton Diggle, New Zealand Shipwrecks, and I recommend it to you. It's all the shipwrecks for the last 200 years. This is the 8th edition of a book that was first published by Ingram and Wheatley. Charles Ingram was a fireman in Dunedin who got interested in ships, and he brought out the first edition, but this is the 8th edition that just came out a couple of years ago, and there's a 9th edition currently being worked on. New information comes to hand, so some of the records get rewritten, and of course there are new wrecks to be added as things progress. Anyway, if you want information about a wreck on the east coast of the North Island, you'll find it in here. And it's arranged chronologically from 1795. So that's the Bible of shipwrecks. And all I'm doing today is picking out a few, as you can see, which I think are of particular interest. Other sources of information, of course, are Stevenson's book on the port and people of Napier, the port-to-port book, and also the book of Richardson's of Napier. This is Gavin McLean's book, published 2005, I think it was. It was a rewrite of Sidney Waters' book of the same title, which came out 20 years earlier. But this again, if you want to know anything about Richardson's and the trade out of Napier servicing the ports of the east coast down to Wellington and up to Auckland, this is the book to get. Plenty of photographs and all the technical information that you want. So those are the sources of information, and they exist, and if anybody wants more information, that's where to look for it. By way of introduction too, I thought, just by making an observation, that those who are living today are probably more disconnected from the sea than any previous generation. And I think that's probably a truism. The sea doesn't matter so much to us. If we want to go travelling, we catch the plane, or we hop in the car, because we've got the infrastructure in the country now to do it. But prior to 1900, transport around the country was all by sea. You had to catch a boat, you had to catch the Wallawalla at Napier if you wanted to go to Wellington. Or you had to catch one of the more local steamers if you're wanting to go up to Gisborne, or up to Wairoa, or Mohaka, or any of those places, like Kakapu, up the coast. So the sea was very, very much on everybody's mind. And I remember, even back in the 1940s, I remember a church singing for those in peril on the sea, and a boys' brigade, "Will your anchor hold?" I mean, and those have more or less dropped out of our conversation now, because those are not the key issues of the day. but they were right through the Second World War. What I'm suggesting to you is that as a generation, we're probably fairly remote now from the sea and as remote as any of our previous generations have been. And on that tack, I might ask if anybody has experienced a shipwreck personally.
Had a relation is on the way handy, but...
Thanks, Bill. Has anybody got a shipwreck in their family history? Kirsty?
Yes. A ship's bell from the wreck of the Tongariro of Mahia. That hung at the end of the veranda of the home up the east coast where I was brought up. And it was rung with great vigour by my mother to call us to meals when we were wandering over the hills. We would come when that bell rang. We knew we had to come. But somehow my grandfather had acquired that bell and it was given to my father to have on that farm.
Do you know where it is now?
Yes, one of my nephews has it. He lives on the Itineroto Road out of Gisborne. Beautiful brass bell, big solid thing.
Bill has brought us this morning to a seat off the wreck of the Northumberland at Napier.
That fabric is called moquette.
We'll come back to this because the flotsam and the jetsam and the bits of wrecks are still around. And here's some examples. Somebody asked me what was the difference between flotsam and jetsam. Well, there's actually three things. There's flotsam, there's jetsam, and there's laggam. The flotsam is what floats ashore and you pick up on the high tide mark. It's just the floated material. The jetsam is stuff that has actually been jettisoned. It's been thrown off a ship. So it's been deliberately heaved off to lighten the ship to try and perhaps light the load and to be able to salvage the ship because it then floats higher in the water. Bales of wool, for example, would be jetsam because they've been thrown overboard in an effort to lighten the ship. And it's what you do on a ship if you run aground, particularly if the tide's coming in. Throw everything overboard and hopefully you'll become lighter and still be able to float and get off. That's an aspect of maritime history that I'd like to develop a little bit in the future because you can have near wrecks or you can have strandings. These are wrecks that would have been had things gone wrong. They have been situations where things have come right and the ship has been saved and has disappeared over the horizon and out of people's memory. But the strandings have sometimes equally interesting stories as total wrecks, except there's no cargo left on the beach.
So what was the third item that you mentioned?
Laggam. Laggam is stuff that is thrown overboard but which is buoyed. It has a rope with a marker on it, like a flag or something like that, or a float. So it is tagged. And if you go back through history, you'll find that the laws pertaining to wreck and the recovery of artifacts from wreck change from time to time. But anything that is marked as it comes ashore is in a different category altogether. It's already spoken for. So that's a laggam. Buoyed jetsam, if you like.
Jim, I haven't been in a wreck, but when I was a child, the weekend visit to West Shore, which was where the airport is now, we always went afterwards to the inner harbour to look at the wreck of the William Wallace, which was sticking up from the water. Do you know about that one?
I don't. I've heard the name, yeah. If you want more information, of course, you go back to the newspapers of the day and see what the reporters were writing. And you'll find the early reporters were very good and gave very factual and detailed information. So if you're interested in a particular wreck, it's worth hunting back through papers past and getting the reports of the day. Sometimes you can even get the results of the court of inquiry that was held, because most wrecks hold a court of inquiry afterwards. Our family has a shipwreck that I'd like to tell you about sometime. It concerns a ship called the Avalanche, the Shaw Savile ship. She had three masts and she was square rigged on all three. She was coming out of London and into a storm in the Dover Straits, and another outgoing ship going to Canada ran straight into her. It was a straight collision at night in a storm, and an avalanche sank within 3 minutes. The Canadian ship capsized and was still floating 3 or 4 days later. There were some survivors, but the family interest is that my great aunt was on board. She was a sister of my grandfather, and so we lost Margaret on that occasion. And the history of the Avalanche off Portland Bill has been very much part of our family history. And because a number of families in Whanganui and in Wellington were involved, the Avalanche keeps turning up in terms of there was a centennial service held in Whanganui for it, and the families still get together. But that's the story of the avalanche, and there's quite an interesting tale to tell about that. But I think you'll find many families in New Zealand do have stories in their family history relating to wrecks or of near rescues or loss of life even. If that happens, it's always good to be assured that these things are written up and that they are recorded in family histories. Turning to the east coast of the North Island, Dingle fortunately has a locality index at the back of here, so if you want to find the wrecks of Cape Kidnappers, you can look up Cape Kidnappers at the back, and it'll tell you that there were three wrecks around Cape Kidnappers. The trouble is your place of interest may not be the same as Linton Dingle, so sometimes you find that the wreck you're interested in is actually under Hawke's Bay Other, or East Coast Other. But sometimes you're lucky and you find that a particular site is referenced. But going through that, I can tell you that there are 168 recorded wrecks on the coastline between East Cape and Cape Palliser. Some of them have been well recorded. There are probably a few wrecks that aren't even included, that have escaped notice or predated the record keeping. But of those 168, we're not going to deal with all of them today. But I've picked out one or two of particular interest, and we'll work from the north down, right up near East Cape on Hororia Point. When you take the road from Te Araroa up to the East Cape Lighthouse, close to the sea is Hororia Point, and that was where the Port Elliot went ashore in 1924. So that's our northernmost wreck of the day, if you like. Port Elliot, she was about 7,000 tonnes gross, 471 feet long. She was a four-masted steamer, which is a bit unusual. It more or less indicates that she was built as a sailing ship and then had engines placed later. But she may have been built with both, probably built with both. But she's recorded and registered as a four-masted steamer. It's one of the good wrecks. And I call it a good wreck because it really was nobody's fault. The ship was coming down from Auckland. It was a foggy night, fairly calm, coming down off the coast here. The captain had noticed that there was a tidal rip that comes through this way that would have driven him onto the shore there, and he adjusted the course of the ship to counteract the drift of the tide and retired to his cabin for the night and left the third mate in charge of the bridge. The third mate, when they're about in that position in the fog, he kept seeing a light ashore, and he assumed that that was the East Cape Lighthouse. It kept coming and going because it was a foggy night and you didn't have continual visibility, so he couldn't get a good fix on it. But they assumed it was the East Cape Lighthouse and they altered course to their right as they were coming down and ran ashore because they'd turned to starboard too early, and they turned south and went straight onto the rock. As you know, the geomorphology of a lot of the east coast of the North Island, you have this wave cut platform at about low tide level. It's covered at high tide, but at low tide there's quite a platform of rock carved into the mudstone by the wave action. She came in on the half tide and the tide was going out, and in the morning there she was sitting high and dry up on the wave cut platform. Well, the Tutanekai, which was the government ship run by the Marine Department, and it was used for servicing the lighthouses and for taking members of Parliament to Wellington and other official duties, the Tutanekai came 5 days later and took everybody down to Wellington. She was carrying 2,500 tonnes of cargo, and they were mostly motor cars. Well, the good news was that the two coasters, the Fanny and the Ruru, managed to salvage 107 of those motor cars, and they took them down to Wellington along with 800 tonnes of fittings that they managed to take off the wreck. The wreck was in pretty good order, so it was a fairly straightforward matter of stripping her. She wasn't a new boat, and she had been in trouble before too, so the decision was made to abandon her on the site. In the certificate of inquiry that was held, it was decided that there was no wrongful act performed, and all the certificates of the officers were returned, and that's why I say it was a good wreck. They salvaged most of the cargo. Nobody was in error or had made a blameful decision. It was an innocent misidentification of the light in a foggy situation. The light ashore proved to be a bushfire. Somebody was burning off, and of course in the fog at night it was mistaken for the East Cape light. So that was the Port Elliot. While we're up there off East Cape, I'm going to claim something for Hawke's Bay, and that's the wreck of the Rangitane. That wasn't a wreck, that was a casualty of war, and it was very close to our own shores. And this happened in 1940. It actually happened 300 miles out to sea. She was bound from Auckland heading for Cape Horn. She was 2 days out from Auckland and was intercepted by the German raider Orion and her two supply ships, the Comet and the Kolmelan. So the three ships were involved. They put a salvo across her bow. She didn't stop. The captain immediately radioed that he was under attack, and then his wireless equipment was carried away by a salvo of fire, and the Germans opened fire on the ship because the captain hadn't stopped. End of the story was basically that there were 303 survivors, but there were quite a number of people killed, certainly five passengers killed and five crew, so we know of 10, but there may have been more as well. But there were 303 survivors. The Germans took them all on board and took them up to an island in the German archipelago and put them ashore on the opposite side to one of the copra groves there. So they had 2 days' walk before they could give word to the world that they had survived. Interestingly, a couple of days beforehand, the same German raiders had taken the Homewood, bound from Chatham's for Wellington, and it was intercepted. I had the good fortune some years ago of knowing a Fred Abernethy who lived in Manukau on the Manawatu coast. He was the chief engineer on the Homewood at the time. And one day he pulled out his diary, which he had kept, because they were on the German boats for about 2 weeks before they were put ashore again. Basically, they were well treated. And of course, a bit of an embarrassment to the Germans, because they had 300 more mouths to feed every day. So the faster they could put them ashore somewhere, the better. Fred Abernethy gave me his diary, and together we later published it in the Ship and Marine Society Journal. And that gives a whole account of the Homewood interception, the Rangitane intercept, and then what happened to the survivors. Again, it was a reasonably happy outcome, if you can forgive them for the fact that there were 10 people killed in the gunfire, and if we acknowledge the fact that this was going on not very far away from home. So I think, being only 300 miles east of East Cape, we can claim it as an East Coast casualty, if not a wreck in the conventional sense. Coming down the coast, we come past this little bay here near the mouth of the Waipu River, just south of Port Awanui. That was a staging point for steamers, they would call in there and pick people up. There was a hotel on the shore there. It was surveyed as a township. Ivan Hughes, who sometimes comes to our meetings, he and Stephanie wrote this book, Port to Pasture, which is the history of the Port Awanui. If you go there now, it's just a green paddock. In fact, you had difficulty realising that anything of interest had gone on there in the past. But I give full credit to Ivan and Stephanie for researching this and publishing it so that it's available information. But this would fall into the category of one of the ports of the past. This is a port that survived for a number of years, but technology improved and the need for the port subsided. The roads went in and there was no further purpose in having a calling point on the coast at Port Awanui. Coming south to Gisborne, 1912, we have the Star of Canada. Now, I mention the Star of Canada because if you go to the museum in Gisborne and go down the long alleyway there and out the back, you'll finish up on the bridge of the Star of Canada. It's still there. They've retained that. It was in private ownership, but it's been handed over to the museum and is now central to the maritime section of the museum. She was one of these misfortunate boats that dragged her anchor while in the roadstead. In other words, she was standing off Gisborne at the time. Midnight on the 23rd of June 1912 happened. Very wild night, gales and squalls, and she started dragging her anchors. And the short story is that she finished up on Kaiki Beach, broadside onto the rollers. Happy, the Gisborne tug went out to help, but she was a 7,000 ton ship, 470 feet long. She was one of the star ships, similar size to the Port Elliot that we're talking about earlier, but of course an earlier wreck than the Port Elliot. She was broadside onto the waves, and of course on a sandy beach with an onshore wind, it's a pretty tricky thing to get a big boat off, and I doubt even a bigger tug could have helped. I'm not sure where the tack got its name happy, but I noticed up in Gisborne that the name of the dredge, or the dumb barge they use as a dredge, is the Pukenui. Now, Puku is tummy, and Pukenui will be the big tummy, which I think is rather a brilliant name for a dredge. Somebody's got a sense of humour in Gisborne. On July the 3rd, it was confirmed that the ship had broken her back, and once that happens, there's no hope of salvage at all. The crew were exonerated, and in the terms of the day, without the slightest stain on their professional reputations. So everybody did what they should do, or could do, but again, this was a misfortune, and we could say that it was simply a case of the power of the sea overwhelming the ship in the circumstance. Neither anchor were able to hold her in the circumstances. So that's the Star of Canada. I want to come down now to the Mahia Peninsula and the several, as all down the coast here, there's 169 wrecks to explain, so I'm missing a few on the way. But I'm going to mention here the Falco on this little point here of the Mahia Peninsula, 1845, and it's probably one of the earliest important wrecks. Falco was a brig. A brig is a two-masted ship with square sails on both masts, not the triangular fore and aft sail, but the square sail, so she had the full rigging of a bigger ship. She came from America, and she was sailing from Wellington to Auckland, and she had on board the American consul for New Zealand, probably the first consul. Now, he had quite a number of things with him, including quite a lot of specie. Specie is the term given to coinage or money, and there were several cases of coinage on board. Presumably it was American currency. He had been given it by the government. Well, anyway, they put in a table cake for provisions and had anchored off, but again, a north gale blew up and blew them onto the rock-cut platform with a heavy sea running, pitching heavily. The windlass was carried away, the windlass that was holding the anchor, so they tied the anchor to the mast, but then the mast was carried away, and the ship ended up again on the wave-cut platform. Tide went out, and there she was, bold and beautiful. Well, they managed to get the American consul and his money bags, or cases of money, ashore, and taken to the home of Mr. Brown. But there the story finishes, so we don't know what Mr. Brown and the consul got up to after the wreck. But while so doing, the master and the officers were hemmed in on the quarter deck, and the hatches were broken over by the European and the Maori whalers. They broached the entire cargo, they opened all the mail that was on board, and in the course of the next few days, they eventually stripped the hull of all the copper that was on her bottom, all the sails, all the rigging, everything they could lay their hands on. Now, you could say, well, that's a bad wreck. That's an example where total pillage happened at the mercy of the locals. But again, it depends on which side of the fence you're sitting. When you are more or less in survival mode and living hand to mouth by day with families, most of them would have been married with half-caste children ashore, or most of the whalers were married, things were pretty grim at times. So having a ship like this arrive on your back door with all these goodies was very much of a temptation. And if you go back to English history again, you'll find that the English, being on an island like we are, were quite adept at picking off wrecks and even causing wrecks when things got tough. And as Bathurst says in her book, The Wreckers, for a fully laden general cargo vessel to run aground in an accessible position is more or less like having Selfridges crash land in your back garden. So if you're in survival mode and a wreck happens, then there is a lot of booty to be had. And as the case of the Falco here, it was the copper sheathing, it was the rigging, the ropes, it was the sails, all these things were most welcome in the whaler's camp. On the other hand, if you were the owner or the skipper or member of the crew of the boat, you'd have a different perspective on it. That book, The Wreckers, the book examines the myths, the realities and the superstitions of shipwrecks and uncovers the darker side of life on Britain's shores. And it certainly is an interesting book. And you realise just how desperate some people were. And if you could lure a boat ashore when you were in starvation mode, that was a good thing for the local community. And they did this by changing the lights on the headlands, putting up force signals, all things like that. And things got pretty grim too, in terms of there could be arguments on who got the wreck at shore. There was a time when any survivor off a wreck could make claim to the wreckage that washed ashore. But the locals cottoned onto that, and it's recorded in some instances the locals would go out into the surf and drown the survivors as they came ashore, so that they could not lay their claim for the cargo. There is a darker side to it all. Again, it depends on which side you're viewing the position from. Leaving the Falco, which is a wreck of a particular interest, we come down to head to Napier, and I just want to mention the Montmorency, 1867. The Montmorency under Captain Josiah Hudson Mackenzie. She was about 700 tonnes, about 168 feet long. She was built in Quebec as a Blackball liner, the Blackball Shipping Company. She was remarkably roomy, and she was a great favourite for immigrants because of the extra space that you got. I came across a passenger ticket the other day, £18 for a steerage passage with 10 cubic feet of storage space to come from England to Napier. But anyway, the Montmorency had arrived in Napier, all the passengers had got ashore, all the luggage was ashore, there was just the general cargo still to be brought in. When again a northerly gale came up, she went on fire. And one suggestion was that the crew were so happy with the girls ashore that they thought they might stay, so they set fire to the ship deliberately. But, you know, that's down in the conspiracy theory department. It was never resolved exactly how the fire started, but it appeared to have been started, and it lingered in the hold for some days before it actually got away, and the gale would have just exacerbated the whole thing. And by midnight, she was heavily ablaze, anchored out there off Napier, pitching heavily. They tried to beach her, that's when she ran aground, but that was not possible. The ship had been burned to the waterline. The Montmorency was a ship, so she was three or four masted with square sails and all. She was an immigrant. There is a photo of her in one of the books I noticed, a good-looking boat, and fairly beamy, and she had this reputation of plenty of space. But you'll find a lot of the early immigrants would trace their arrival to one of the trips of the Montmorency. This wasn't the first trip by any means. It surprises me a little bit that there isn't a painting of her on fire off the Napier Heads, because it seemed to me it would be a little snippet of history. It happened at night, so she would have been quite spectacular as her masts went up in smoke and flame. Eventually she was stripped, all the copper and sails and rigging were taken off. So that was the Montmorency, one of the immigrant ships that we lost here. The other ship that we have was some years later, 20 years later in fact, the Montmorency in 1867, and we have the Northumberland in 1887. The Northumberland was an iron full-rigged ship under Captain Richard Todd. He's a well-known Napier skipper. She was formerly a steamer, so she had converted back to sail, which is interesting, but that sort of thing happened. And she was owned by the Shaw, Savile and Albion Company. She was wrecked on the Bayview Beach on the 11th of May, 1887. And she'd arrived 2 days earlier from London and Lyttelton. She had 1,000 tonnes of cargo on board, including a lot of material for the Wairoa Road Bridge that was being built at the time. She'd also had 4,000 bags of wheat that she'd taken on board for Lyttelton, which would have been going back to Europe. In the gale on the 10th of May, the cables parted, the spare anchor was put out. It seemed to hold, but it started dragging again in the late afternoon. By the time nighttime came, they tried to put a tow line across to one of the coasters known as the Wecker, but the tow line broke and the ship went on into the breakers. There was another ship involved at that time, the Boojum, which was a much smaller 70-foot boat belonging to the Union Steamship Company. She went to her aid, but got caught in the rolling sea on the beach and capsized. The engineer was saved, but four crew members were lost. So in the Boojum attempt at providing rescue for the Northumberland crew, she herself was wrecked. Bill has got an interesting thing here, an artifact from Northumberland, and you might like to tell us about that, Bill.
I bought this at auction about 1.5 years ago. This is a chair of the Northumberland. It's got a heavy steel base, which I guess would be screwed to the floor. There's a couple of these around. There's one in Faraday Centre Museum. I think we decided it was probably made about 1871, and the other one I've seen has got the same material.
Which was?
Moquette.
So is that for the pattern or the actual type of material?
The type of material. My grandparents, I remember from my childhood, they had sofa and chairs upholstered in moquette, which was very like that.
It's up until a couple of days ago, this seat was covered in a black material, and I just started poking away, and I was really pleased to find that I had the original material that matched that, because I bought this for $200 at Manson Foster's auction. So I think having this original material sort of increases the value of it somewhat. I'll probably hang on to it myself now. But obviously they've got a lot of stuff ashore, because when you walk around there, I suppose most of you have been around there, have you, and looked out to see the remains of the ship there?
Quite a lot was exposed during the 31 earthquake, apparently. Yeah. But yeah, you're quite right, there are still bits and pieces that can be seen at low tide in the right circumstances. Well, I guess the boot jumper's there too.
I've had a good poke around on the beach to see if I could find anything, but I didn't see anything, a couple of little bits of wood. I don't know if they're off that or not.
Keep looking, because I know every tide can change things. The Northumberland, built in 1871, she also had this figurehead, which graced the garden in Carlisle Street for some years. It was later seen in Whakatū, but that figurehead is sort of dipped below the horizon now. It probably fell to bits.
Who is it all, the figurehead?
It looks like a Viking gentleman, probably a Northumberland man. Or whatever, there's usually some association between the figurehead and the name, but yes, not necessarily. Yeah, the figureheads are another topic altogether. The art of ship carving. There were figureheads and there was scroll work and there were stern plates that the ship's carver did. If you go to Adelaide, you'll find the museum is packed full of figureheads, because they're one of the few retrievable items that they managed to get. And of course there were lots of shipwrecks along the South Australian coast due to the difficulty of navigating in the winter. Hang a left to go into Adelaide or hang a left to go into Melbourne. If they did it too soon, they ended up on the shore. Lots of wrecks there. And there are a few figureheads in New Zealand still, but they're few and far between. There was a collection in the Navy Museum at Devonport, but they were left out in the rain and they mostly had weathered and disappeared. And the two remaining ones are in the museum. I think they're great. They're part of the maritime art, and there's not a lot of maritime art left now, but they're quite unique. There's lots of myths and stories associated with the figurehead, and if ever you see one, it's worth trying to find out a bit more about the ship that it came from. So that's the Northumberland and the Boojum. You could put the Boojum up there. 1887, but if we go around here to Cape Kidnappers, we have the little coastal steamer, the Go-Ahead, that also went ashore that same year. So I've chosen three wrecks there, the Northumberland, the Go-Ahead and the Boojum, all of the same year. The Go-Ahead was a smaller steamer. She'd been built in County Larnach in 1867. She was 20 years old, which is getting quite old for a ship. She went ashore at Rangaika, which was where the whaling station was, Morris's whaling station, in very thick weather. Everybody got ashore in the lifeboat all right, except for the fireman who hung back and said he wasn't going to trust his life to a lifeboat, but his bets were in the wrong place, and he lost his life. The interesting thing about the Go-Ahead is that you can still see the boiler. If you go out at Cape Kidnappers and out onto the Rangaika coast and look down onto Rangaika, where the New Zealand dockerel are now breeding, in a slow tide, you can see a rusty old boiler out there, and that's the Go-Ahead. Going further south to Akatea, out from Dannyburg. Yeah, there's Cape Turn again. There's Castle Point and Akatea. Anyway, the Pleiades. This is a ship that intrigues me a bit. Happened in 1899, this wreck. An iron full-rigged ship belonging to the Shaw Savile and Albion under Captain Thomas Burton. Ran ashore on the 31st of October 1899. At daylight, she was found to be dangerously close to land, and efforts to wear her were unavailing, being a sailing ship. They couldn't work her off the shore with the way the wind was blowing, and it was an east-southeasterly gale, and the captain decided to beach her to hopefully save the ship and to save the cargo and the passengers. The first mate went up in the rigging, and from there he directed the helmsman towards a sandy beach. So they're off Akatea here, coming up this way. He spotted the beach, the Akatea River here, and he could see there was sand there, so he thought that would be a good place to try and take the ship. Miraculously, they went straight over the reef off Akatea, there is a gap in the reef, and they managed to get the boat in the gap through the reef and up to the beach. Avoiding the reef was quite miraculous.
Well, she took the ground at 8 o'clock in the morning in an upright position. The crew landed by lifeboats, and 20 were later taken back to Wellington on the Himitangi. She was not worth the expense of refloating. She was 30 years old, and 30 years is a very elderly sailing ship, so she was dismantled as far as possible. The Court of Inquiry found that the master was quite right in beaching her, but he was guilty of negligent navigation, and he was given a 6-month suspension, and he ordered to pay half the court costs, and the chief officer was ordered to pay the other half of the court costs. So there was a fair bit of blame put on the men and responsible on the bridge. The interesting thing is that if you go to Akatea at low tide, you can still see something sticking out of the water. It may be the stem of the boat, it may be some other part of one of the masts or something. It's not visible at high tide, but it is visible in a low tide. So you still can see the Pleiades.
The second interesting thing is that if you go to the community centre, Akatea was a pick-up point for Richardson's. They used to pick up wool from there on the coasters by loading the wool by bullock wagon through the surf. And to store the wool, there was a shed there. The shed was still there in the early 1970s. I remember seeing it. It was used for parties and socials and so forth, but got to the point of becoming a hazard. They pulled it down. But they've rebuilt a very good community centre there with accommodation and a big hall above it, just behind the school. And if you go there, you'll find the bell of the Pleiades in a point of prominence in the hall. It's nicely mounted and all polished up. That's what happened to the bell of the Pleiades. She also had a figurehead, and for some years it was believed that she was in the custodianship of the Armstrongs in Akatea here, but I've not been able to locate that figurehead, and the last report I had was that somebody thought it had got beyond repair and had been thrown in the river. That may be as may be, but if any of you happen to hear about the figurehead of the Pleiades, it would be interesting. There is an unknown figurehead in the Maritime Museum in Wellington that could possibly be offered, but nobody has been able to substantiate that. And our last little wreck is another little ship at Akatea, a little ship called the Catherine Johnson, and this is a ship that I have some affection for because it belonged to my great-grandfather. It didn't belong to him at the time of the wreck. He had sold it a few years previously. But the Catherine Johnson was built in Sydney when William Watt and Thomas Taylor were in Sydney in 1840. They purchased the Catherine Johnson from the builder, and together they stocked her up with everything they thought they could sell in New Zealand. The family record is that great-grandfather William left Sydney with a ship full of cargo and half a crown in his pocket. And they subsequently came to Auckland and then finished up trading successfully between Wanganui and Wellington and Nelson, sort of a triangle route there, with the occasional foray back across to Sydney. This little ship, 10 tonnes, 31 feet long, she was a cutter rig. They actually took her back to Sydney a couple of years after buying her and had the builder lengthen her and then brought her back to New Zealand. So she has three crossings of the Tasman to her credit, which is pretty good for a 31-foot boat. So that's the story of the little Catherine Johnson, and that brings the whole story of these shipwrecks, for me anyway, to a personal note, and that here's a bit of our family history. My brother has spent the last 20 years building a boat in Port Chalmers, and you can imagine the name he has given it. Those are 10 examples of the 169 I could have talked about, but I think they're all of special interest. And if we just go back and look at them chronologically, we've got the Falco, which was the first one, and then the Catherine Johnson was actually the second wreck, the Montmorency, and then 1887 we had the Northumberland, the Boojum and the Go-Ahead, that little group of boats. 1899 down to the Pleiades, the Star of Canada up at Gisborne, the Port Elliot up at East Cape, and of course the Rangitani during the Second World War. And if we look at the reasons for those wrecks, we can see that in some occasions it was simply that the ships were overwhelmed by the sea or by the wind or by both. We can say, well, the Catherine Johnson was overwhelmed. Captain Armstrong of the Armstrong family had taken her in
and he was bringing her out to return to Wellington, and as he was coming out over the bar, he got caught in the breakers and unable to turn the ship and catch the wind and get himself out. So he got what they call caught in the stays. This is a position where you've got your bow into the wind and you can't turn to the left to get out, and he couldn't turn to the right because he would have gone onto the beach. So that was the end of the Catherine Johnson, but you could say she was overwhelmed by the circumstance. We had the war casualty, the Rangitane. You can have errors in navigation, and I think we could put the go-ahead in that category. And the Pleiades too, she was obviously too close to land. And in fact, my little suspicion about the Pleiades was that she was conveniently wrecked. I suppose I could be taken to court for saying that in public. But this does happen. When a ship gets old and is worthless and it's going to cost you money to get rid of, why not wreck it and get the insurance? And here we have the Pleiades, a 30-year-old ship, which was past her use-by date, conveniently beached on a beach that had access to it. Not really a formed road in those days, but at least it was access to getting the wool out of the whole Dannyberg area. I just wonder if there was a bit of skullduggery went on there. Wrecks weren't always innocent things. They were sometimes deliberate. We have examples of fire here with the Montmorency. We have examples of wanton destruction and plunder, as in the Falco up at Mahia. And all those things contribute to the wreck saga on the East Coast. The other aspects of maritime history that this opens up, I'd like sometime in the future perhaps to tell you the story of HMS Osprey, one of Her Majesty's brigs of war, which in 1842 went aground up near the Hokianga. And that's interesting because there is always a bit of a suspicion there that she was actually wrongly signalled. There was a flag put on the beach by the pilot to enter the Hokianga harbour if the bar was sufficient depth across. Now, just north of Hokianga, there's another little harbour called Herakino. And from the sea, she looks very similar. She has the same relief in the hills behind and could be mistaken. And a flag was put out on the beach of Herakino. And so they assumed, oh yeah, we're at Hokianga, let's go in, straight into the lap of the shore. So that's an interesting little story. That was researched by a wife, dairy farmer, in the Waimate area up in north, and she's written this wonderful little story, Ship on Shore. And it's a story of how a couple found this wreck on the beach in recent years, you know, last 20 years, and through their curiosity and persistence, they managed to unravel the whole story. This wonderful story of the wreck of the HMS Osprey. There are other things too that I mentioned before that wrecks bring up. A wreck is a very definite full stop for a ship, if you like. But there are also ships that do hit the land in strandings, but then get towed off. And often the circumstances of that stranding and the consequences are really interesting, and as interesting as wrecks themselves. They weren't wrecks because they managed to be salvaged. I would call them the nearly wrecks. I can tell you the story of a couple of them too, where circumstances were right and the ship was saved. And then of course there's the whole question of ships that never made it at all. And I mentioned to you before the Avalanche that sailed from London for Wanganui and Wellington and didn't get past Portland Bill. And okay, that was a wreck in a sense, but it was a collision at sea. But there are other boats. One particularly, I've done research on a ship called the Britain's Pride, Captain Linklater, in 1876, which set off from Hobart for Wellington and was never seen again. It had the two daughters of the owner on board. Linklater was one of the most respected captains on the coast at the time. Boat never arrived, so there's a great big question mark, you know, what actually happened? She was obviously overwhelmed in a sea and lost without trace. But there are other ships like that. And a friend of mine in Dunedin is actually writing a book on the forgotten ships, the ones that left but didn't get here. This brings up the interesting issue too of the ports of the past, the ports that were of significance like Wairoa, Mohaka. You'd never think they got ships of the Mohaka when you go and look at it now. Waikokapu, very important when they were building the railway to Gisborne. But all around the New Zealand coast there are ports that survived for a little while, particularly during the early days when there were no roads or rail, but are now forgotten. And Port Awanui was one example of the ports of the past. It's interesting too to look at the cargoes of these early ships, because there you have the whole economy of the country sort of explicit in the manifests, what they were taking and what they were bringing. In the early days it was pork and potatoes from Whanganui and from Napier. The ships would take that to Wellington and they would bring back all the goodies that were necessary, calico, ironware, pots and pans, sugar, tea. And so you can get a lot of the early history just from reading the manifests of these early boats. And then of course it's the issue of genealogy. When you get all the ships lined up and you know who the masters and the owners were, then you've got a rich source of information about some of the early members of families. We've touched on the question of ship art and the figureheads and the carvings on ships, which is another interesting topic. But those we will leave for another day. Thank you for your attention. Bill, you had a bottle of whiskey.
Yeah, this is a bottle of Hennessy brandy that came off the wreck of the Rangitonovich, wrecked in 1873 at Cape Jackson, at the entrance of Queen Charlotte Sound, without loss of lives. At the time of the sinking, the locals were reported to have stocked up on booze for years to come. And here's a photo of artifacts recovered from the vicinity of the wreck. Note the empty booze, so this might be one of the few bottles around that hasn't been emptied. So I don't know what it tastes like, but I guess that's the rank seal, is it? So it's kept it in good nick. So I don't know how many bottles there would have been on board, but that's something I bought at Percy's auction about 12 years ago.
Well, Jim, when we came, I think most of us here, like me, that we're going to hear about a couple of 300 or 400 ton ships that crane. Your definition of a wreck, and then the 168. See, that's why not too many of us want to have salt in our veins. It's more dangerous than cars. The one I liked particularly was your family, a 10-ton ship. I thought, that's a good exaggeration. I thought a boat three times across to Australia. You've got some mad people in your family, Jim. But thank you so much for the interest that you've created in this, and I'm sure that we'll always think of different things about shipping, and especially our own coast. That's the biggest surprise to me, that I've lived here all my life and I didn't know any of this. Thank you very much.
Has anybody got a burning question that they'd like to ask?
Were you in the Navy in the Second World War?
No, I was still a schoolboy.
My father was on the Achilles in the Navy from 1933 through 1946, and probably one of the wrecks that he was on is the Achilles got badly hit in 1943 up in the Suffolk, and then they had to transfer to the Gambia.
The two boats that were taken over by the Germans, were they scuttled?
Basically, well, in the case of the Homewood, I think the Germans actually opened the Seacocks, but then did some artillery practice on her afterwards. So she was deliberately sunk. And the same with the Rangitane. It was not an attempt to take the ship. They were embarrassed enough by the number of people they rescued. And there was another ship too, taken in the Tasman Sea by those German raiders. And now the records on the German side are coming out. We're getting the diaries of the crew and the officers of those German ships at the time.
What reason were they down so close to how much
it was? Oh, it was deliberate. Trying to sabotage supply ships. They knew that this was the source, Australia and New Zealand. Ships were leaving here with meat and dairy produce. Yeah, basically food materials, I guess, and wool. And they were trying to intercept them. They laid mines off Wellington. They laid mines off Auckland. And one of the mines took the Niagara. The ship hit the mine going out of Auckland. So they were quite active. And it was just, trying to make a nuisance of themselves. And also put the wind up us. I remember Dad going around in the meeting, and we used to have an air raid or blackout practice. We had a hill up in Oklahoma that overlooked the harbour, and out for Sinclair. The practice was always to put up the plywood shutters so the lights could not be seen that you couldn't see. And that was in response to either the Germans or the Japanese possibly coming.
And also the submarine that was meant to have come in today, is that correct?
Well, I think it's pretty true.
I'd like to know, why has there been so much secrecy about the Mikhail Lermontov? Captain Jamieson was never brought to charge.
Good question. Richard Pringle, who's in Havelock, 3 or 4 years ago, down in the community centre. So I heckled him. I didn't harangue him, I heckled him. He was Minister of Marine at the time, And my question was why there were documents in the National Archives which had a 100-year freeze on them that relate to the medical limit of red. So the inquiry was held, but the official record of that inquiry has been, like all court cases, in custody for about 100 years. It's got a long way to go. But I didn't get a reply. He just said, oh, if you believe in conspiracy theory, you believe in conspiracy theory. So there is no answer to that question, what the real circumstances were or what the outcomes were. Russia actually owed us a heck of a lot of money for exports. And there was a question of whether it was a political problem, if we got sloppy with the wreck, that the Russians could have refused to have paid. So I think there are still interesting issues about the Mikhail Lermontov. Thank you, everybody, for coming.
Thank you.